I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today we'll be listening to the first half of our interview with Stephen Eric Bronner, professor of political science at Rutgers University and the author of Reclaiming the Enlightenment, Towards a Politics of Radical Engagement. I'm speaking today to Stephen Bronner. Dr. Bronner is director of global relations at the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He's the editor of the prestigious intellectual journal Logos. He's the author of many books, including Socialism Unbound, of critical theory, Blood in the Sand, and the Erosion of American Democracy, and the book that we're talking about mostly today, Reclaiming the Enlightenment Toward a Politics of Radical Engagement. Thanks for coming on, Dr. today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
Now, I should say you're at Rutgers University.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Have you, 30 years there?
Longer than that.
We don't need to go into that.
Right.
Okay, so now you, I confessed that this interview, this research topic is a part of my own reclamation of intellectual history that I should have done quite a long time ago about the importance of the Enlightenment in shaping all the ideas, the progressive political ideals that I have grown up with and advocate for, but didn't really understand their roots. And I take it that this is the part of the rationale for the project for you as well.
Indeed. Basically, the story goes like this. I've been traditionally very, very interested in critical theory and various offshoots of the idealist tradition and of Marxism. And one of the classic works of the 20th century was Dialectic of Enlightenment by Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno. And what this turned into was a critique of the Enlightenment, a thoroughgoing critique of the Enlightenment, a critique of its universalism, of its commitment to science, of basically the philosophical assumptions on which modern liberalism and modern science and modern universal ethics and humanitarian ethics rest. And Horkheimer and Adorno were going to write a sequel, which they were going to call, in German, basically Salvaging the Enlightenment. And so they never wrote it. And I think they never wrote it because their critique was so thoroughgoing that they no longer had anything positive to say. And someone had to write it, so I decided I would try, within the spirit of critical theory, to do a critique of, shall we say, the purely philosophical, aesthetic understandings of freedom and in a work that would confront the cultural biases of a left that's become, unfortunately, intoxicated with relativism, with subjectivism, and with a certain, I don't know, sense that the Enlightenment could be taken for granted and its success could be taken for granted.
Let's go back for those of in the audience who similarly are not up to speed with their intellectual history. Let's define the Enlightenment and the counter-Enlightenment, and then we'll work our way up to how the Dialectic of Enlightenment by Horkheimer and Adorno fits into that whole dialogue. So what is the Enlightenment?
The Enlightenment is a period, in the first instance, a period roughly from the 17th to through the 18th centuries, in which there emerged a new concern with liberalism, with representative democracy, with civil liberties, with a basic notion of tolerance, with an idea of the split between public and private existence, but also, and above all, with in philosophical terms, with a new preoccupation with universal ethics, thus a new notion of humanity, with science as a kind of exploration of the universe, that allowed new possibilities for freedom, leisure, and the like to arise. And this notion was contested by a counter-enlightenment, which arose roughly at the same time. Most of its cruder representatives are forgotten. There would be people like Johann Hamann in Germany, later Joseph de Maistre in France. But its real father is probably someone like Edmund Burke in England, who is remembered. And the Counter-Enlightenment basically was an attempt to contest the emphasis on reason, the idea of rights, or of universal rights that had emerged with the Enlightenment. It was an attempt to reassert the power of throne and altar, or what Stendhal later called the red and the black, the army and the church. It was, in short, an attempt to reassert traditional authority in its social and political and philosophical terms.
Do you believe that there is a legitimacy to dividing the Enlightenment into a Scottish and continental variety? I mean, a lot of contemporary Enlightenment historians seem to want to emphasize the diversity and the internal contradictions of different kinds of Enlightenment trends.
You see, my concern was basically this. There are obvious differences between the Scottish Enlightenment, the German Enlightenment, the French Enlightenment, the American Enlightenment. Different places give rise to different ideas. Different conditions give rise to different ideas. However, basically, in my view, basically, the ideals for which were fought for in these different places were roughly the same. And interestingly enough, the enemies, or the ideals of the enemies of these different Enlightenments, were roughly the same. The Enlightenment's great heritage was a cosmopolitan one. The idea of what they called a republic of letters. Let me give you an example. Immanuel Kant read David Hume. Voltaire read Locke. Goethe translated plays by Voltaire and Rameau's nephew by Diderot. And you can go around like this. There was a basic interconnection, and that was part of the charm of this entire enterprise. It was a transnational enterprise, a genuine cosmopolitan enterprise. I think the first of its kind. And that to me is the most important element of the Enlightenment, not the particular form that it took in this or that nation.
One of the ways that I try to describe it to people is that they generally agreed that the ideal society would be one where free and equal individuals had discussions about how to do their affairs and went forward together in progress. But one strain of that was the notion that we could all just make contracts with each other, a kind of Lockean radical anarcho-capitalist notion. And at the other extreme, it was the notion of radical democracy, that those discussions would be collective self-governance.
Yes, that's certainly true. There was a notion, and what's important to this notion, I think, is the following. In terms of the social contract made between individuals, the idea of the citizen arose. And by definition, in the great figures of social contract theory, whether it's Hobbes or it's Locke or it's Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the citizen is stripped of his or her empirical qualities, in principle. That is to say, the law has to speak to and treat fairly all citizens. And to this extent, one has a notion of the citizen as indeterminate, without empirical qualities. This is exactly, and this contests, if you like, the sexism, the racism, the anti-Semitism that many Enlightenment thinkers believed in. In other words, the principle contested the residue of prejudice that existed at the time. A perfect example of this is Martin Luther King making reference to the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal, or all are created equal, as a way of challenging the racism that existed in the South.
Or the way that French revolutionary ideals inspired Haitian slave revolts, even though the French revolutionaries didn't intend to do that.
In Haiti, for example. And it also inspired the liberation movements in South America, Simon Bolivar and others. If I were to put the Enlightenment into a sentence or two, I think you can do that. And that sentence or two would come from the play The Marriage of Figaro by Beaumarchais. And the line goes in the following way. Figaro, the commoner, confronts an aristocrat. And he says to this count, "What have you ever done to earn your privileges aside from being born?" And with that phrase, which was actually uttered at court when the play was shown, this came to be known as the clarion call of the revolution. And I think the idea is very, very simple. Traditional privileges of birth, of sex, or of gender, or of race, in principle, have to be contested from the standpoint of the Enlightenment.
And by the way,
there's something that goes along with this, because here we have sort of the rational, critical, socialist element. There's also something else within the Enlightenment tradition, which is very important, I think, which is the emphasis on common decency. The attack on torture, for example, really takes shape within the Enlightenment. The concern with a kind of modern politeness, a tolerance even for homosexuality, and a new sort of cosmopolitan sentiment that I mentioned before. I actually call it a cosmopolitan sensibility, to contest the kind of emerging nationalism of the period. I think this is a pretty impressive
We saw an echo of that with President Obama lecturing the Christian far right on the importance of civility at the National Prayer Breakfast.
Yes, there is a basic way in his, especially in his style, and in the liberal concerns of his policy, or the liberal elements of his policies, even his concerns for social redistribution of wealth, no matter how they've been compromised, you can see an Enlightenment quality within President Obama. I think that's pretty evident, at least in the style.
Absolutely. Okay, so we have the liberal elements, the importance of the rights of the individual, freedom of speech, and so on. We have the socialist critique, or the egalitarian critique. And again, many historians would talk about the strains between those two spectrums of thought. You want to emphasize their fundamental unity.
Yes. Let me see if I can do it in the following way. Again, cutting to the chase. Essentially, in political terms, and this is basically what everyone agrees upon, most people agree upon, that liberalism, as a political philosophy, is an attack on the arbitrary exercise of power by the state and by various social institutions like the church. I think that's fairly clear. Now, what I would suggest is that capital is also a social institution that acts arbitrarily without necessarily reference to the public good, and so that. While it's true that the Enlightenment was tied to the great bourgeois revolutions that took place in England and in the United States and in France and elsewhere, the principle guiding the Enlightenment contests the commitment of its own representatives to the emerging capitalist world.
Okay.
That's what I would suggest. And so you have something very interesting. If you consider the main events of since the French Revolution, and actually even going back to these revolutions themselves, what you find is that Enlightenment ideas are basically carried on by liberal movements and by socialist movements, and that counter-Enlightenment ideas basically carried on by conservative movements and even fascist movements. Now, I'm not saying that every conservative is going to be opposed to every principle in the Enlightenment. All I want to do is suggest that there's a warranted assertion for making this kind of connection.
But within Marxist-Leninism, we can find many of the kinds of nationalist and cult of personality, other aspects of the counter-Enlightenment.
That is certainly true, and I try and talk about that a bit, both in this book, Reclaiming the Enlightenment, and in another of my books called Socialism Unbound. Let me put it this way: if you think of the Leninist tradition, one of the things that's very interesting is that the Leninist tradition contested the historical stage theory and the science of Marxism. Marxism is a coherent doctrine. For example, Antonio Gramsci, whom many of your listeners will know, former head of one of the founders of the Italian Communist Party, and a great theoretician, actually, in his own right, said that the Russian Revolution was actually, in his words, a revolution against das Kapital, because Marx believed that the revolution could occur only where there's a large working class and in the most highly developed countries. He believed it would take place probably in the United States or in England. That, of course, wasn't the case. What Lenin, Trotsky, Gramsci, and even the best heads of the best thinkers of the communist movement, George Lukács, all of them placed a new emphasis upon will, upon revolutionary will that would allow constraints to be objective social constraints to be called into question, that would, if you like, call into question the coherence of the original theory. Was Lenin in himself a person committed to Enlightenment ideals? Well, in a way, he was committed to creating a modern society out of the feudal one. Was he committed to liberalism? Well, in his early writings, he did commit himself to a republic. But as the Soviet experiment wore on, it became very difficult to create a socialist society without a large proletariat and a new society predicated on wealth in a completely devastated nation. Lenin too had believed in an international revolution, and he was left with a revolution in one country. And so, ever more surely, a situation emerged in which there was a breakdown of the connection between ends and means. And one of the things within the Enlightenment tradition was the demand, if not for an absolute, then at least for a plausible connection between theory and practice and ends and means.
This has been the first half of our interview with Stephen Eric Bronner, professor of political science at Rutgers University and the author of Reclaiming the Enlightenment, Towards a Politics of Radical Engagement. For the second half of the interview, you can listen to it at IEET.org. The IET is very happy to welcome as a fellow David Brin, who's a science fiction author and a well-known blogger. He blogs at the blog Contrary Brin. He recently published an essay called Defending the Enlightenment, which is very much the theme of what I've been thinking and writing about these last couple weeks. And I wanted to read that to you. Brin starts his essay by recommending the book The Anti-Enlightenment Tradition by Zeev Sternhell, in which the Israeli philosopher covers a vital topic, resonant with many things he's been saying about how the progressive Enlightenment is under frenetic attack by those scheming to restore older oppressive ways. And then he goes on, that is, David Brin goes on, only with an important difference that prompts me to offer up an observation and a cavil. For when I speak of the Enlightenment, I'm referring to something much more modern and ongoing than what campus academics refer to when they use that word. To me, it stands for the great experiment of Western civilization, the sole time that any post-agricultural society discovered a viable alternative to the age-old human attractor state, the standard pattern that dominated perhaps 99% of culture since history began, rule by inherited oligarchy. Yes, our current experiment evolved out of the French Enlightenment of Voltaire and Rousseau, but what we have today and must defend against concerted assault is only related to that drawing room debating society as a child is to its grandparent. Indeed, had the Enlightenment depended only upon its French idealist wing, whose love of abstraction sometimes borders on the mystical, the movement would long ago have foundered. It is the Anglo-Scot-American offshoot, with its emphasis on pragmatism, reductionist science, otherness, inclusionism, and material progress in the physical world, that truly changed the world. It is this wing that kept the Enlightenment alive by powerfully resisting and then quelling the fascist and Stalinist empires, and it was also responsible for spreading both practical advancement and modernist ideals to all corners of the globe. This is an important distinction, for while the French and American branches of the Enlightenment share many values, a belief in progress and human improvability and divided and accountable power, in free argument and in the value of the individual, the more abstract French wing turns about and partakes in a kind of madness that is rooted in bad old habits that stretch all the way back to Plato, the notion that one can logically derive important conclusions about reality via words alone. Given that Plato turned out to be just about the most anti-Enlightenment philosopher of all time, an implacable enemy of democracy and science, this descent of reason should be troubling. Indeed, the obsession of scholars associating the Enlightenment with abstract reasoning runs smack up against what should be considered the Enlightenment's greatest insight, that humans are inherently delusional beings, able to talk ourselves into anything at all. The French idealist branch acknowledged this problem and replied that the answer would be found in better reasoning, a well-meaning but inherently untrustworthy prescription, one that is, in fact, delusional in its own right. By contrast, the pragmatic scientific wing said, "Everybody will be deluded as a matter of basic human nature, and we are terrible at spotting our own errors. Rationality can be just another method for incantatory justification and rationalization. But there is another answer. If we cannot spot our own mistakes, we can often notice each other's. Through well-run competitive systems like democracy, markets, and science, the give and take of reciprocal accountability can edge us ever forward towards the truth." Oh, sure, these competitive systems are hard to set up and maintain. As one of the earliest leaders of the Anglo-American wing, Adam Smith, described, it's hard to arrange circumstances under which competition delivers all its benefits, creativity, innovation, vigor, accountability, and error detection, without soon drawing in its own worst enemy, cheaters. As both Smith and Karl Marx pointed out, capitalism and democracy can turn into their own worst enemies. These pragmatic tools require endless fine-tuning, a gritty chore that often makes people tempt to turn back to simplistic dogmatism. Still, the Enlightenment needed this path away from the trap of essentialism, in which Rousseau and Hobbes railed at one another over flawed, overly simple descriptions of human nature. It was John Locke, founder of the American Anglo branch, who said, "Wait, you are both right and wrong. Man is both noble and corrupt. We are complex, and we need systems that can harness that complexity, rewarding the noble traits and binding the corrupt ones. Towards this end, abstractions may inspire, they may lift our hearts, but they do not get the job done." Hence, my conclusion to a garrulous aside, it is wrong for well-meaning scholars like Sternhell to continue calling the abstract idealist branch of the Enlightenment its defining center, not when most of the movement's greatest continuing achievements were attained by the other pragmatic and materialist branch. Not only does this ignore the Enlightenment's greatest strengths at a time when it is under siege by deadly foes, but this old-fashioned fixation seems obdurate, scholastic, and even rather quaint. And that's a piece by David Brin, a new fellow of the IET, called Defending the Enlightenment, which we published from his blog. David Brin is, of course, the author of many novels and as well a couple works of nonfiction. Sadly, IET fellow George Dvorsky has been too busy recently to continue his podcast series, his Sentient Development podcast series. But he recently published a piece on Sentient Development's blog that we republished at IET that I wanted to share, which addresses a central techno-progressive idea, the importance of eliminating poverty in order to address the vulnerability that civilization has to catastrophic risks. In other words, that we want to make our civilization more resilient in the face of all the natural and human-made potential disasters by eliminating basic forms of poverty and then in creating general abundance of one sort or another. So at any rate, George's article here is called Rebooting Haiti, Eliminating Poverty to Reduce the Impacts of Disasters. With the search and rescue efforts officially called off in Haiti, the time has come for reconstruction. But with nearly 200,000 dead and 1 in 9 Haitians currently homeless, it's easy to get caught up in the numbers and lose sight of the primary lesson learned from the catastrophe, that poverty kills, and it kills big time. Stop for a moment and imagine an earthquake of similar magnitude in San Francisco. It's highly unlikely that we'd see a similar death count, not with San Fran's first-world infrastructure and emergency response network, not to mention the support from surrounding areas. But we don't have to imagine these things. Back in 1995, the great Hanshin earthquake rocked the Kobe area in Japan, killing more than 6,000 people. This earthquake hit 6.8 on the Richter scale and struck a heavily populated area, very comparable to Haiti. And in 2008, the Sichuan earthquake killed nearly 68,000 people in China, a country that sits firmly between the first and third worlds. There's obviously a direct correlation with the relative affluence of a community and their ability to cope with disaster. There's no question that the death toll in Haiti was severely accentuated by the poor state of affairs in that country. It's all fine and well that the world's attention is now focused on Haiti, but the damage has already been done, an outcome caused directly by the earthquake and indirectly by years of global neglect and indifference. As Mahatma Gandhi once said, poverty is the worst form of violence. Indeed, this is exactly the kind of unintended violence we impose upon the impoverished peoples of the world when they're largely forgotten. Moreover, the violence that's unleashed by poverty is hardly limited to the impacts of natural disasters. As Peter Singer recently noted, every year more people die from poverty-related causes than the entire population of Haiti. It's clear that poverty has to be eliminated, and Haiti offers a remarkable opportunity to take a de facto post-apocalyptic society and set them on the right track. Success in this matter would provide an unprecedented blueprint for similar reconstruction efforts around the world. Here's what has to happen in Haiti. All the money that's pouring in has to be routed to the right areas. While aid agencies are doing an exemplary job dealing with the initial humanitarian crisis, they are far too chaotic, uncoordinated, and decentralized to rebuild the country. Rebuilding efforts will have to be conducted by dedicated transnational institutions working in tandem with private industry. Haiti's infrastructure will have to be rebuilt from scratch. This will include roads, ports, housing, electricity, sanitation, and water. The entire Haitian country has to be redesigned for resilience in anticipation of another earthquake. The development of viable economic opportunities is paramount, particularly ones that are sustainable. Agriculture would be a good start. Haiti has some of the sweetest mangoes on the planet. Looking further ahead, however, the country's infrastructure needs to be brought to first world standards if it hopes to compete and do business with the rest of the world. All this is easier said than done, I know, and quite obviously the reconstruction effort will be more complicated than my 4 bullet points. But we have to start somewhere, and something has to be done. As Bono of U2 once said, "We're not looking for charity, we're looking for justice." That was George Dvorsky on Sentient Developments talking about rebooting Haiti, eliminating poverty to reduce the impacts of disasters. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.